Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, July 31st, 2017. A top electoral official is found dead in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, as the country prepares for elections.
There's no doubt that he was tortured and murdered. I know postmortem will be done. In our mind as a commission, the only issue is who killed him and why.
And new technology helps tell the story of the people of Nuba Mountains in Sudan.
When they put the VR film headset on and they started looking around, seeing the environment, a lot of them started getting emotional. And then some of them said, okay, I can only watch for 5 minutes and I have to go because I'm very busy. And when they put the headset on, most of them watched the entire film.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The manager of technology operations for Kenya's Electoral Commission has been found dead 9 days before national elections. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Officials Monday confirmed the death of Chris Masando, who had been in charge of managing information technology systems for Kenya's Electoral Commission. Word of Masando's death comes 3 days after he was last seen alive. Wafula Chebukati, chairman of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, spoke from Nairobi's city mortuary.
There's no doubt that he was tortured and murdered. I know postmortem will be done. In our mind as a commission, the only issue is who killed him and why.
Calls to Kenya's police spokesman for a response went unanswered. Chebukati urged all electoral employees to remain calm as they go through the national mourning period. He also made a request of the government.
And at this point in time, I demand from the government that they provide security for all employees of IBC for us to give Kenyans a free and fair election.
As manager of the IEBC's ICT operations, Masando had in-depth knowledge of the technology being used in the upcoming elections. Chebukati also announced that Monday's launch of an electoral simulation exercise would be postponed until further notice. Fears of violence have been rising as Election Day draws near. Opposition parties have accused President Uhuru Kenyatta of seeking to rig the vote, while the president said his main opponent, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, is trying to divide the nation along ethnic lines. Odinga lost the hotly disputed 2007 presidential election, which triggered violence that killed more than 1,100 people. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
New technology now allows filmmakers to create lifelike experiences that tell stories of people trying to survive in the Nuba Mountains. A new film shot in Nuba Mountains is designed to immerse viewers into the lives of the people of Nuba who have been caught in the middle of conflict between the Sudan government and rebels of the SPLM North since 2011. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
The loud and intimidating sound of Antonovs flying overhead have become familiar to many people in the Nuba Mountains.
The ground shook. It felt like the bombs were landing on top of us. The shelling landed so close we had to lie on the ground.
Those are the words of Hanan, a Sudanese woman living in the Nuba Mountains, speaking through a translator for an American-made documentary called We Who Remain. Draped in a long sky blue dress, Hanan can be seen fetching water while taking care of her children. With the new technology, viewers feel like they are standing right beside her as she speaks. Released in March, We Who Remain uses virtual reality goggles that simulate the viewer's physical presence in the film. So instead of just watching the violence unfold in front of their screens, viewers feel as though they are huddled in the same cave where Hanan and over a dozen children run for cover from bombs being dropped overhead. Filmmaker Ryan Boyette says viewers of the documentary not only see the realities of what Hanan is living through in the Nuba Mountains, they feel it as she fetches water and helps children take cover.
Her husband is an SPLA North soldier in another village somewhere on the front lines, so no one was there to help her. She ran away, she got in the cave to hide from the bombing as well, and months pass as she's trying to gather leaves, cook roots of trees that she has to boil for hours and hours.
The Niubu reports say the conflict in South Kordofan between the SPLM North and the Sudanese government began in mid-2011. The comprehensive peace agreement between Khartoum and southern Sudan left the Blue Nile in South Kordofan in Sudanese territory. In June of 2011, fresh clashes between South Kordofan troops and Sudanese troops broke out in Kadugli, further igniting tensions. Amnesty International has accused the Sudanese government and the SPLM North of engaging in sporadic military attacks in rebel-held areas. Amnesty also accuses the Sudanese government of directing aerial and ground attacks at civilian objects while denying humanitarian access to civilians. Bayet says the international community, including the U.S. government, can play a role in bringing peace to the region.
Right now in the U.S., the new administration hasn't appointed any new positions that are overlooking Sudan, like the special envoy position is not filled. People in the State Department that normally look over Africa issues is not filled. So we need people in these positions to at least address the issues of Sudan and make decisions on what's happening there.
Boyette says he wants to show the film to U.S. officials and staff who have been working on Sudan issues but have not had the chance to visit the country.
When they put the VR film headset on and they started looking around, seeing the environment, a lot of them started getting emotional. And then some of them said, okay, I can only watch for 5 minutes and I have to go because I'm very busy. And when they put the headset on, most of them watched the entire film. So they were so entrenched into this VR film like they're in a different world. And I think it really helped when you explain things for people to see what the Nuba Mountains is like, hear the voices of people as they're speaking to you like you're in their environment, and that really helped to explain the situation.
And that is the effect that Boyette and his team want viewers to feel. Boyette says he hopes to bring attention to the deadly conflict in the Nuba Mountains, one viewer at a time. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Sluggish economic growth and other factors have weakened the quality of government policies and institutions in sub-Saharan Africa. That's the conclusion of the World Bank's yearly country policy and institutional assessment analysis for Africa. The report rated 38 countries according to several criteria. Among them are economic and public sector management, structural policies, and social protections for the poor. Rwanda, Senegal, and Kenya came out on top of the survey. Others that have shown improvement include Cameroon, Madagascar, Sudan, according to the lead economist for the World Bank, who spoke to VOA's William Eagle.
There were a fairly strong, as you'd say, headwinds that were impacting a range of countries. And then there were domestic issues in some countries. In some cases, policy uncertainty. In others, it could be security and instability. It could be the drought, which had implications on food markets and food prices, and therefore inflation. And in some countries, the drought had an impact on generation of power. There were challenging conditions. And in a large number of countries, macroeconomic management became quite complex and challenging. And we saw slippage in several countries.
Speaking of those countries who met some of these challenges head on and did well, which countries were among those that met the challenge and succeeded?
I would say that the countries that managed to keep their scores relatively high, and Rwanda would be one of them, were able to meet some of these challenges, which is not to say that fiscal deficits didn't weaken, but there were an effort to prioritize spending, to rein in expenditure overruns, to contain wage bills, and to address inefficient subsidies, as well as efforts to strengthen tax administration. And here using technology, you know, so it is easier for citizens and firms to make payments using, you know, technologies, electronic filing, reducing the number of procedures and the hours it takes to make payments, as well as strengthening public financial management, you know, better monitoring of the budget, better fiscal reporting, and stronger audit systems. So all of these are, I think, things that countries have taken.
In this survey, how did some of the continent's largest economies rank? I'm thinking of Nigeria and South Africa.
One important thing to bear in mind, Bill, is that we are only looking at IDA borrowers and countries that are eligible for IDA, which is the concessional arm of the World Bank. So it provides concessional resources and grants. South Africa would not be included in that. It's not an IDA borrower. Nigeria is there. Nigeria saw a slippage overall in economic management. There was policy uncertainty. There was segmentation of the market for exchange rates. This had implications on both investor confidence, but also on the non-resource-rich or non-oil sector. And the country did see drop in the value of its currency, as well as a rise in inflation. So there were issues on the economic management side. There was slippage, which tended to pull down the score of Nigeria. So it did drop to a score of 3.3.
Another country where we've heard of a lot of progress going on is Ethiopia, especially in its capital, Addis. Was Ethiopia among those countries that fared fairly well in terms of improving and adjusting its institutions and economic policies?
I think Ethiopia did manage to improve in terms of economic management, because I think they were able to contain the fiscal deficit. They went through, remember, the country was hit by a drought last year, and they were able to contain the fiscal deficit. So there was an improvement in that area. They also have made, I think, strides in social protection. So the score for Ethiopia, it held up. It has a score of 3.5, which in the context of African countries is on the relatively high side.
When you mentioned that it had made some progress in social protection, are we speaking in terms of a safety net or the inclusion of women?
I'm talking about safety nets, you know, the main form in which social protection is provided to the more vulnerable and poor. And in Ethiopia, they have a fairly strong safety net, have been able to respond to the climatic shocks. Actually, this is one of the things we see across Africa, that there are about 46 countries now in the region that do have at least one safety net program at the national level.
That was Pranam Chohanpole, lead economist for the World Bank Africa region. She was speaking to VOA's William Eagle. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new counseling facility in Bor is helping people deal with trauma. That story is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you like most about football?
I'm not really into football, like, that's the truth. Maybe the players, if I hear, maybe Ronaldo, maybe, you know, just that.
The excitement and the fanfare that goes with it, with everyone so interested, the discussions, the whole show, even the game itself is also exciting.
Unfortunately, I'm not a football fan. The way people now put emphasis, the way people now put all their time, the time they should utilize in building their skill in football, I saw it as a distraction.
What I like most about football is the togetherness, the unity it brings. When you see football, they are screaming on top of their voice as if they've been friends from childhood. So football brings unity and togetherness.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A counseling center in Jonglei Estate is helping people suffering from trauma after witnessing brutality of war. The Alam Counseling Center provides residents with psychological counseling for free. Deng Guy has more for VOA from Bor.
24-year-old Sarah Anyeth lost both of her parents during Sudan Civil War in 1991. She was transported to Khartoum by relatives where she completed her primary studies in an Arabic school. Last year, Anyeth enrolled in the University of Juba. Speaking in Dinka, Anyeth says Her problems coping with trauma began while she was working on her degree.
I was doing my diploma in accounting in the University of Juba. I was left only with 1 year, but in the due course I became pregnant and could not continue with my studies, so I dropped out. Later, after I gave birth, my husband abandoned me, saying he no longer needed me. I was left with nobody to take care of me and the baby. Because I had lost my parents and had no job, life became very difficult. Then I became overstressed and no longer behaved normally.
Anyet says the alarm counseling center has taught her coping mechanisms that have helped her deal with trauma. Now Anyet says she is able to work and feed her 4 and 7 year old children and send them to school.
I am now changed psychologically, and this was because of alarm. Without them, I would have not recovered. I thank God and this counseling center very much. I am now accepted to work in a restaurant here in Bor. Before, no one would accept to employ a mad person, but thanks to God, with this job, I can feed my 2 children.
27-year-old Mary Duke says she too was traumatized by problems connected to the fighting in South Sudan about 4 years ago.
Since I lost my husband in the 2013 war, I became the father and mother of my children, which is very stressful. I've been selling firewood to feed my 6 children. Earlier this month, I went to the forest to commit suicide, but some people found me there and brought me back. There was where I found myself in this center. I am now feeling better, but the problem is how to feed these children.
Duke says insecurity has increased in the forest, making it more dangerous to gather firewood. Mayom Arok is a counselor at Alarm Counseling Center in Bor. Arok says most of the alkaline come from vulnerable groups.
Everyone can be traumatized, but mostly most of the clients are, especially the young women who have children and they are widows. The other categories are old age people who cannot have people that care for them. The disabled group, mostly people who do not have any income, they are the majority among the clients.
To help people like Duke and Anyet, Global Trauma Project recently held a 3-week training session on trauma healing in Bor. Ilya Yasevich is the executive director for Global Trauma Project.
People are being trained in how to identify kind of the impacts of trauma and stress, how these things affect people, and what to do about it, like how to help ourselves when we're affected by stress and trauma. So now the 53 people that have been being trained from all around Bor, they will then start conducting workshops in the community for people to attend.
Deng Ding Agwer, who attended the session, says he is happy with his new skills and will be sharing his new knowledge with others in the community.
We are traumatized more than any other person in the whole of South Sudan, to be honest. Bor people, because of so many crises. But the lesson learned here, as we go out, we will basically be practical.
The Alarm Center is currently treating about 50 patients at the Bor facility. Alarm also has counseling centers in Pibor and Tonj. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
Social media sites like Facebook and Twitter have become a powerful medium in promoting hate speech as well as encouraging moral behavior. Chirdeng takes a look at how the social media has changed the landscape of politics and ignited discourse, both constructive and destructive, among South Sudanese at home and in the diaspora.
Many South Sudanese diaspora with access to internet and smartphones say they're making good use of social media to promote peace. But a survey by the United States Institute of Peace found out that some South Sudanese use the platform to voice their grievances through inflammatory language and images. Gordon Boy is the Deputy Chief of Mission at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington and is responsible for Council and Diaspora Affairs. Boy has gotten attention for some of his controversial posts on Facebook. The UN panel of experts on South Sudan identified Boy as one of the prominent South Sudanese who use Facebook to post inflammatory messages. Boy says his Facebook posts are defending the South Sudan government.
For example, in March, if you heard about it, there were groups in America who wrote in the social media that Salva Kiir died, and then there was a war between Paul Malong and Coleman Young on succession. I think you heard about it. All the shops in Juba were closed, and people and Salva Kiir had to come out to show to the people that, oh, I'm alive, I'm not dead.
But Boy has posted several messages on his Facebook page about Riek Machar as well. In 2016, he alleged that Machar could no longer see with his right eye. In one of his posts, Boy claimed that one of Machar's legs was amputated and he was in a coma. In addition, Boy posted pictures of Riek Machar and his wife, Angelina.
Because people in the diaspora, they use social media, and we have to use social media in order for them to have information which is accurate, not the fake ones, because there are so many fake news in the social media regarding South Sudan.
Some activists use Facebook for a different purpose. Groups like Anataban and the South Sudan We Want post videos that combat online hate speech. Jacob Bull, a member of Anataban, says most of the online hate speech is generated by members of the diaspora.
People in diaspora are disconnected to what is happening back home. So whatever information you get from any source that you get it, or maybe from social media, you think that is a positive, that is the real message. But if you get down deep to, trying to filter this message that you get and get deep into knowing the exact information, then at some cases you'll get is the false information.
Jeffrey Duke is one of the founders of the South Sudan We Want, a group advocating for peace. Duke agrees with Bull. He says his group uses Facebook and other social media platforms to promote peace and denounce violence.
The campaign uses Twitter and Facebook and YouTube for dissemination of the messages that...
Duke says he has seen how powerful social media is in advocacy. South Sudan politician Pagana Moom says he was a victim of hate speech. He says he was portrayed as a rapist and murderer. Pagan sued the woman in the United States who abused him online. Amoom says some posts on social media can be very harmful.
It ceases to become a free speech and become a hate speech when the content is inciting violence, is demonizing and dehumanizing persons for whatever reasons that they aim, either they aim to destroy them or they want to justify committing crimes against them.
Peace Tech Lab, an initiative of the United States Institute of Peace, conducted research to identify sources of hate speech. The research found the diaspora as the main perpetrators of hate speech. Several examples of hate speech were found on websites such as the Sudan Tribune and African Press. The research notes that both sides to the conflict have used hate speech to incite violence. For VOA News, I'm Cher Deng from Washington.
South Africa entered an economic recession in June, and the country's unemployment rate is fast approaching 30%, according to Government Statistics Agency. But for the sellers of second-hand books, business has never been better. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Eric Noefel shows a customer around his store in Johannesburg. He's been selling used books for almost 30 years. Noefel says he recently faced intense competition before launching his fifth bookshop in the city.
And my ex-wife also wanted to open up a shop in this area, but I beat her to the punch, so she's a bit pissed off with me, actually.
He says establishing the new branch is one of the best decisions he's made.
I'm making money, and it's going into my third month, and that's pretty good for a new business to make money so quickly. Books have come back.
It's a big contrast to 5 years ago, when Noefel sales dropped dramatically. Book lovers were embracing electronic reading devices like Kindles. He had to close 6 stores. But now Noefel says the Kindle craze may be over and many South Africans want to turn real pages. Yet many of his clients give another reason for no longer buying new books.
They've gone up a hell of a lot. Obviously, it depends on your import or your rand level.
The rand has dropped steadily against the dollar since the end of 2011, when $1 was valued at about 8 rand. Presently, a dollar is valued at 13 rand.
A new book should cost you about the price of a meal. In the UK, that's about right. A meal costs about £7 and a book costs about £7. Yeah, on the other hand, a reasonable meal for one person will cost you about 70 rand, 80 rand, and a book costs 350. People just can't afford books.
Dealers across Johannesburg put the number of second-hand bookstores at about 50, up from about 25 just a few years ago. But used books are not always cheaper. Doron Lockett's unpacks hand-me-down books inside his shop. He says despite the poor economy, some South Africans spend big money on rare second-hand titles.
We sell a first edition of Long Walk to Freedom, and the big thing about it was signed pre the release date by Mandela. It went to one of our collectors.
Lockett sold the autographed copy of Nelson Mandela's bestseller for almost 80,000 rand, more than $6,000. But he says the collectible book market is very small, and he mostly sells used books to a general audience.
I'm delighted to increasingly see more black customers, younger ones who really have, many of them, a passion for books.
Economists are predicting a bleak outlook for South Africa for the next few years. So second-hand book dealers like Lockett's expect sales to rise even further in the near future. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
That report by Darren Taylor from Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song and then a ballad Jadid by original Ras Corby. Been listening to Ras Corby with the song and then Bella Jadid. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning in. You can drop us a comment about our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also look us up on our Facebook page, that's South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.